This is the fourth lecture on the history of the commons and enclosure. The readings that we focus on today are Carl Polanyi's The Great Transformation and Peter Linebaugh's Magna Carta Manifesto, Liberty and Commons for All. The focus is on the medieval commons because that was where many of the patterns that we see today first got their start. And it also illuminates the transition from feudal times to modern markets and the liberal state, which helps us see more clearly the different logic and frameworks and worldview of commons as they contrast with markets. The basic question raised by this history in my mind is, what is the economy? What constitutes the economy? Nowadays, we associate the economy with the market. But it's important to remember it wasn't always so, and that the market often had really a grounding in a larger social context and community. Now, in terms of the English commons, which is kind of an archetype, a cultural archetype in the Western mind at least, there were three general stages. There was the period before the Norman conquest in 1066, in which village lands were held and worked communally. But the period that really is of most interest to us are the second and third periods. One, the medieval times when land was connected to the lord of the manor, and the lord in turn was connected to his vassals in very complex bonds of mutual obligation. And then the third period was the period from about the early 18th century to the mid-19th century, a period of industrialization, when the English commons were enclosed in another fashion. But to go back to the medieval times, this was the period in which the lord was officially the owner of the land, not in a modern sense of having absolute discretion over how he could use the land, but that he was the one in charge. Even though he was bound up with a whole set of traditional obligations that he could not just summarily dismiss. For example, the lord couldn't sweep aside the commoner's rights to use the meadowlands and wastes, so-called, which are the uncultivated lands, for their subsistence purposes. And in turn, the commoners had all sorts of obligations to the lord in terms of tilling his fields or giving him some of their crops, most notably serving in any military forces that had to be raised, oftentimes giving money when the commoner's daughter was married. So it's not as if the commons were without hierarchy or power dominance in relationships like that. There was subordination and unequal power, but it was very stable and durable and was very tailored or grew up organically with the environment itself. It was eco-friendly, we might say today, because the commoners were both co-producers and co-users, and they had direct feedback loops from the production methods they used, unlike, it's worth pointing out, the market, which famously displaced all sorts of costs onto nature and other people rather than internalizing them. Now, one of the great periods of enclosure started in 1536 when King Henry VIII eliminated the Catholic monasteries, and so he unleashed a round of enclosures by lords and nobles. The historian Peter Linebaugh calls this a massive act of state-sponsored privatization because it allowed the land to be made a commodity. It was essentially a land grab by the rising class of gentry. And it was also a period in which the fellowship of mutual aid that constituted the commons was essentially dissolved. And this paved the pathway to pauperism, basically. Linebaugh also points out that enclosures destroyed the spiritual claim on the soil by the commoners and prepared for the proletarianization of the common people. It's also worth noting that this period, roughly from the 1490s to the 1640s, these periods of enclosure produced tremendous ecological destruction, such as soil erosion and depopulation of the countryside. The other great period of enclosures of the commons was, as I mentioned earlier, from the early 1700s to the mid-1800s, when this time it was merchants and landowners who were more intent on enclosing the commons. Remarkably, one seventh of all English common land was carved up and privatized. These needed the approval of the Parliament because it was seen as abrogating the traditional rights of commoners. And so essentially, the Parliament and the merchant class colluded in enclosing the commons and dispossessing the commoners of their subsistence rights. Now, one of the major propelling forces in these latter enclosures was wool and sheep. Wool was becoming a major export product, and merchants increasingly wanted to allow sheep to graze so they could produce wool, which in turn helped fuel the rise of the British textile industry, which itself was part of the larger industrial revolution occurring. So this was the propelling force behind many of the enclosures in the latter period. Karl Polanyi, who was a historian of much of this in his book The Great Transformation, called the enclosures a revolution of the rich against the poor. The lords and nobles were upsetting the social balance, breaking down ancient law and custom, sometimes by means of violence, often by pressure and intimidation. They were literally robbing the poor of their share in the commons, unquote. Polanyi also described it this way, the effects of enclosure on the commoners as they were displaced from their villages and their ability to common. He said, the laboring people had been crowded together in new places of desolation, the so-called industrial towns of England. The country folk had been dehumanized into slum dwellers. The family was on the road to perdition, and large parts of the country were rapidly disappearing under the slack and scrap heaps vomited forth from the satanic mills. Polanyi called it a veritable abyss of human degradation. Now, in revisiting the commons, we should take in mind that property was something very different from the jurist William Blackstone's notion of absolute despotic dominion over property. It wasn't a modern sense of property. Commoners had all sorts of rights in common land to serve their subsistence and household needs. So it wasn't kind of the kind of right that we might associate today of having absolute control over things. They had a very well-developed vocabulary for all these different types of rights. For example, if you had a right to graze your cattle or sheep on the common, it was called pasturage. And if you had a right to extract fish from the river or lake, it was piscary. And there was a right of pannage, which meant that you could let your pigs feed on the acorns from the trees, because pigs were an important part of the household economy. If you had turbary rights, you could have turf to burn for heat. And if you could collect the wood from the forest to heat your house or furnish one your house or fix your house, that was called estover rights. And there were many, many other such customary rights. Peter Linebaugh says that writes that common rights are embedded in a particular ecology with its local husbandry. Commoners think not of title deeds, but of human deeds. Commoning is embedded in a labor process. It inheres in a particular praxis of field, upland, forest, marsh, and coast. Common rights are entered into by labor, and this commoning is collective. Commoning is independent of the temporality of law and the state. It grants the He notes how the Magna Carta grants perpetuities. It doesn't list rights. The Magna Carta being a major source of a written document of law acknowledging certain human rights, especially in the Charter of the Forest, which was a companion document. The point is that the Commons goes deep into human history. It has a very or deep organic roots in the way people live their lives. And Linebaugh points out that it's a mistake to think of commons just as a noun. It's really a verb as well. It's a social practice, not just the land. And he says there's really no commons without commoning, which is, of course, the social practices that sustain the commons. This is a very important point because to think of the commons just as a thing or a noun is to misunderstand what made it successful and how it worked. One important point of the commons is that it's a right of subsistence and use, usually based on custom, but it's not the kind of exchange value that we often see in the marketplace or in market systems. It was an entitlement to use certain resources in limited ways, in specific ways, for certain periods of time, which is a very different kind of understanding of property than we have today. In a way, we have to understand common rights as a kind of social security for pre-modern times. It was a way of keeping yourself alive and running your household, especially when there weren't other means of support through a market. And it was a very highly articulated and specific set of use rights rooted in the shared understandings of that community. The essayist and cultural critic Lewis Hyde has a wonderful description of common rights among Californian Indians in his book Common as Air. He writes, "Sometimes people own plots of land, particular trees, or special fishing places outright. In other situations, they owned rights. One family, for example, might own salmon fishing rights from a particular place along a river. Another family might own the eel fishing rights there, and a third family might own the rights to cross the river at the same place." But the point is, no one really had exclusive absolute rights to the land or the river or the forest. It was a set of use rights owned and shared by many people, and it reflected the diverse needs of the community in question. Now, there's two important concepts of the commons that we should mention here because they're concepts that apply to many modern commons as well. One is the idea of stinting, which is a form of limits on one's use rights. One's ability to use the commons was not absolute. There were all sorts of limitations. So, for example, you may be able to cut branches from a tree, but only above a certain height and on certain dates. Or you could cut certain bushes to use to feed your fire, but only to heat your house and not for other purposes. So stinting was a way that to limit people's use rights for certain social or ecological or even moral reasons. And almost all commons were stinted, and that was one way that was made sustainable. Otherwise, you might indeed have the so-called tragedy of the commons that Garrett Hardin talks about, in which everybody could do whatever they wanted. Stinting is one way that management of a finite resource occurred, and how a certain social equity among the community that used that commons could be enforced. And it's worth noting that even markets in those times were often stinted, which was a kind of regulation. For example, townspeople might have the exclusive right to buy during the first hour of the market, so that they could get the better goods. And speculators and retailers might be prohibited from participating in the market till the afternoon. So even markets were stinted. The other concept of the commons that's worth remembering and talking about is something called beating the bounds. And this is when the commoners patrolled the perimeter of the commons to check for any encroachments. Essentially, a way to check for the integrity of the commons and the people's continued control over it. And what happened is it was a community of almost a festival or celebration where people would carry axes and crowbars with them to destroy any hedges or fences or ditches that might have been built to try to enclose the land for certain private purposes. So beating the bounds was like a border patrol or an annual perambulation. And this is partly the origin of the terms levelers and diggers, which were names of certain people who were ardent, aggressive commoners. They would assert the right to knock down any enclosures, so they would level under any hedges that were grown, and or I'm sorry, they would level any stone fences that were created to enclose the commons, or dig under any hedges that had been erected. The point is to reestablish access to the commons for themselves and prevent any private parties from enclosing it. So beating the bounds was kind of a happy, festive community event, which also had the purpose of binding the community together and asserting their peoplehood as a community. And if you were trying to think about how we might beat the bounds today and honor the commons, partly it's done through legal means. There might be licenses, such as the general public license for free software or Creative Commons licenses, which are ways to, in an impersonal legal fashion, assert the integrity of the commons. But then there's all sorts of social practices that say the people of Wikipedia use to make sure that nobody vandalizes the commons or gets bogged down in flame wars for certain entries on Wikipedia. So the notion of beating the bounds is still a very relevant one today. It's a way that the commoners, the social practices the commoners use to protect the integrity of their shared resource. After the period of enclosure, people sometimes still beat the bounds, but it was more of an extra legal custom. It was more of a symbolic social protest against the bureaucratic state and the law than a functional process that really needed to be done to protect the commons, because after all, the commons was essentially enclosed. But there was still a lot of residual resentment, and so beating the bounds was one way that people could almost symbolically, I imagine, probably pathetically in some instances, try to assert their rights as commoners. Now, enclosures are a very important concept in talking about the commons because they help describe a lot of our current predicament, where private parties are taking our shared resources away from us. This is the theme I develop in my book Silent Theft: The Private Plunder of Our Commonwealth. Lewis Hyde, in his book Common as Air, writes that enclosure means a shift away from lives guided by customs preserved in local memory toward those guided by national law preserved in writing. It means a shift in the value of change itself, once suspect and associated with decay, now praised and linked to growth. It means a change in the measurement and perception of time. And here he was referring how in the commons, time was far more linked to nature and not measured and quantified. But of course, when factories arrived on the scene with the rise of markets, everything was rationalized and measured and coordinated, and a very different notion of time emerged than in the period of the commons. Now, there's controversy in some quarters over whether enclosures improved the land or not. In some ways, you could say that there was much greater productivity after enclosures because the new merchants and landowners who were growing sheep for their wool for export were, of course, as eager to produce as much wool as possible, and in fact, they did. The same could be said for certain agricultural practices. But others point out that these practices also tended to erode the soil and destroy the land, for example, by introducing monocultures rather than a variety of different types of crops. But more significantly, the enclosure divided the commons into its constituent parts. So it divided the commoners from the land and destroyed the social practices and use rights and customs that were associated with the commons. And in dividing the commons into its constituent parts, it essentially invented a new type of person, the individual. The individual who was oriented around wages and material gain and the market economy and personal social mobility, and oriented himself or herself to national law and national culture and a new ethic of technological progress. Many of the things that we associate today occurred as the market culture enclosed the commons and began to grow a whole new way of being in the world. So that the bundle of things or of components that constituted the commons, the resource, the commoners, the social practices, were essentially disassembled. The emerging market society found that it could flourish much better by disassembling the commons. What this meant was that the commoners lost their ability to subsist. In many, many instances, a household having a pig and a garden and a small allotment of use rights to the forest was their major defenses against abject poverty or starvation. So the commons played this very important role. Now, understandably, there were a lot of protests about the enclosure of the commons. And one famous one was the equivalent of Bob Dylan of the time had a folk poem in 1764. We don't know who the author actually was, who famously had this poem: "They hang the man and flog the woman that steal the goose from off the common, but let the greater villain loose that steals the common from the goose. The law demands that we atone when we take things we do not own, but leaves the lords and ladies fine who take things that are yours and mine. The poor and wretched don't escape if they conspire the law to break. This must be so, but they endure those who conspire to make the law. The law breaks up, locks up the man or woman who steals the goose from off the common, and geese will still a common lack till they go and steal it back." There were many rebellions and protests by commoners who had been displaced from the village and had no other means of support. Kett's rebellion in 1549 was one famous one. And there were others that gave rise to great civil insurrection and uncertainty in those times. The historian Silvia Federici describes how the how enclosures had a particularly harmful effect on women, because women were disproportionately dependent upon the common as people who were often running a household. And enclosures were accompanied a larger devaluation of women's work and a degradation of their bodies. It's not entirely surprising that during this time there was a huge rise in witch hunts and prostitution. As Peter Linebaugh writes, a motif in the evidence against witches was association with common rites of pasturage, panage, or estivers. So women were associated with common rites, and as property rights came to the fore and women tried to assert their common rights, they were often vilified, demonized, literally demonized. So they suffered a great deal as the new regime of private property rights and ownership took hold and the early young capitalism took off. Peter Linebaugh says that at the times there were, quote, two competing concepts of social morality that prevailed in the mid-16th century, commonwealth and commodity. Commonwealth implied paternalism and hospitality. Commodity implied calculation and guile. As he puts it, the counterfeit countenance was inherent in the commodity form. People who had commodities were, by guile and all sorts of subterfuge, trying to sell it. And this ethic became far more rooted than it did in the period of the commons. Now, it's worth noting that enclosure did have some common positive effects. It did away with the master and commoner relationship and opened the regime for greater individual freedom. It liberated people to have new identities and social freedoms. But it's important to notice that these freedoms cut both ways. It also destroyed the social cohesion of the commons, the means of subsistence, and the whole stability of resources and the continuity of identity that people had. So it was terribly disruptive. And while individual freedom could flourish for a great many, probably most of the former commoners, it also meant they could have the freedom to live lives of poverty. A famous quote by Anatole France noted this with some sardonic humor, saying that the law in its infinite majesty forbids the rich as well as the poor to sleep under bridges, to beg in the streets, and to steal bread. So this freedom to be a wage slave was a dubious freedom in many instances. The market order was creating really a new type of people who were, in Linebaugh's words, migratory, nomadic, lacking in self-respect and discipline, crude, callous beings. Now, it's worth noting that the commons is, therefore, in these ways, very much about identity. It's not only about use rights and the limitations on the alienability of resources, the ability of resources to be sold or not. It was about people's identities being wrapped up in the commons, and the collective enterprise and cultural system that the commons represented. And when the market dissolves those identities into its great impersonal system that prizes exchange value and cash over these so-called soft human values of tradition, morality, nature, and so forth, well, this is a significant change, and it's one that we are still struggling with, especially as market forces insist ever more strongly on being the ordering principle for all of life. Karl Marx put it well to describe this dynamic when he said that all that is solid melts into air. Well, that's essentially what happens when market encloses the commons, because it dissolves the resources, social practices, and identities that were all wrapped up in the commons and turns them all into fungible commodities. And the result is a kind of atomistic individualism that we have today, or I suppose you could say it more succinctly as modernity. Karl Polanyi in The Great Transformation said that with the rise of markets, you really have a double movement. One is the expansion of market logic into every nook and cranny of life and nature, and the other is a counter movement to try to restrain the market and protect social life and custom and morals and the other things that people don't wish to have the market take hold of. So there are all sorts of movements to protect, for example, workers' health and safety, or family life, or the beauty of the landscape, or the integrity of forests and land, or folk life and crafting practices. And in fact, in the 18th and 19th century, you have all sorts of new political pushes to protect society, factory legislation, child labor laws, land use laws, trade unions, antitrust laws, public health laws, and social insurance, and on and on. But this is one of the central tensions that arise when the so-called free market becomes the ordering principle of society. The title of Polanyi's book, The Great Transformation, refers to the period of time in which the market, instead of simply being a ancillary or accessory aspect of human life, became the central ordering principle for societies, which Polanyi points out was an unprecedented development in human history. He calls it the entirely unprecedented nature of such a venture in the history of the race, where we have a profound transformation of humankind's relationship with nature and with people among themselves. You know, markets had existed since the later Stone Age, but their role had always been incidental to economic life and not central, let alone controlling. But with the rise of markets, epitomized by enclosures of the commons, we start to see new categories for organizing life. So, for example, labor and land, which are rather basic elements of life, began to be treated as commodities. And so we have the fiction that labor is a commodity and that land is a commodity that ought to be bought and sold in the market, as opposed to having other attributes that ought to be honored as well. Polanyi points out that the free market was not a natural thing that just evolved by itself. Government had to be actively enlisted to enable this so-called free functioning of laissez-faire markets. Polanyi says, quote, "The introduction of free markets, far from doing away with the need for control, regulation, and intervention, enormously increased their range. Administrators had to be constantly on the watch to ensure the free working of the system." Yet any moves by society to protect itself from the imperialism of the market order have always, of course, been denounced as collectivism. This is a recurring pattern with the rise of market society. Now, the rise of the market system had several key aspects. Social morality shifted from common subsistence of the commons to private gain. You had the rise of machine production and mass markets. You needed mass markets to support the high costs of the machines. All transactions had to be turned into market transactions, and so a money culture begins to take root, supplanting the social relationships of the commons. You had a division of labor for maximum efficiency. And then you have this conceit of the self-regulating machine of the free market as the new norm for how social relationships and production should be ordered. And so the price system becomes the engine of production and social relationships and change. And this is truly unprecedented because, as it's been pointed out, pre-modern history never saw markets as the way that all of society should be ordered. They used markets in a rather supplementary way. It was not how the society was ordered. So in the long sweep of human history, the rise of market culture truly is qualitatively different. Prior to the rise of market culture, there are many permutations of social governance of resources in which reciprocity or redistribution of the resources by tribal leaders or other leaders occurred. And then there were householding type arrangements for managing resources. But we didn't have this dominant market order. After the Great Transformation, all social relationships are then embedded in the economic system rather than the economy being embedded in the social relations. You see the rise of mercantilism, with the state becoming an active partner with markets, trying to break down the boundaries between towns and countrysides as well as between various towns. And the idea was to liberate trade from particularism, the local community, so that trade across geographic boundaries could take root. And while this, of course, had many advantages, it also posed many new destabilizing threats to the very stability of towns as self-governing communities. All of these developments caused really a moral and political crisis. How do you explain, in the wake of enclosures and the displacement of people from the commons, how do you explain both the rise of new types of prosperity and progress and such mass misery and poverty? How can these be joined together? Well, we now can have a little perspective and see that markets were essentially liquidating the organic nature of society, in which the commons prevailed, into its constituent parts of people, resources, and doing away with social practices. But in any case, you had the rise of all sorts of new theories and analyses that linked the cruel laws of nature with those of markets. And so you have Thomas Malthus talking about population growth and its cruel ability to limit growth. You have Charles Darwin and natural selection. You have the utilitarianism of Bentham. And you have Adam Smith's invisible hand, all of them sort of machine-like principles that trumped any social agency that people could have. You were seeing the setting forth of these iron laws of the self-regulating market as if they were inexorable laws of nature that human beings couldn't dare to try to suspend because they were so deeply rooted in the way things are, as revealed by science. However, we do see that these are not as immutable as they've been. And we can see especially with the crises we face in the global economy today, that there are indeed distinct limits to how much nature and how much social life can be commoditized and bought and sold in the market. And that there, if only the example of global warming is showing that we need to find ways to restrain the limits of market culture, if only to preserve the planet and its ecosystem. So we find that in medieval times and the enclosure of the commons, we can see with greater clarity this contrast between social ordering of and management of resources and the new ways of doing it that the market ordains, and how it's not as if we can ever want to aspire to go back to the medieval commons, but it is important to see how such social arrangements can work and how they indeed can work in combination with the market as well. That's part of the struggle that many people are facing today. How can we integrate the market and commons into a more wholesome, if not synergistic, stability, rather than allowing the growth imperatives of imperialistic markets to be the only standard to aspire to? So we'll be looking at this in greater detail in later lectures on specific arenas in which the market and commons are in conflict, and some of the strategies that are being used by commoners to protect their commons from further market enclosure. Next week, we will talk about air and water as a commons and the enclosures of them.